Imagine you're walking out of your front door right now. You are, strolling past your neighbor's house.
Yeah.
And you've done this exact walk hundreds, maybe thousands of times. Now stop. Without looking, what color is their front door?
Right, that's the real test.
Exactly. What does the handle look like? Is there like a scratch on the bottom left corner? If your mind just went completely blank, well, your brain is actively deleting your reality to save energy.
Yeah.
And today, we are learning how to hack that filter.
It is a phenomenal starting point. I mean, because it forces us to confront this really uncomfortable truth about human perception.
Yeah.
We assume we're taking in the world like a video camera, recording everything in high definition. But the reality is that our brains are incredibly aggressive editors.
Right.
They are ruthlessly cutting out like 99% of the visual and auditory data around us, leaving only what is strictly necessary for basic survival.
And that editing process, that deletion of data, is exactly what we are overriding today. So, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is centered around a truly fascinating reality, which is that human interaction is essentially a constant exchange of hidden codes.
Yes,
Whether
exactly.
you realize it or not, as you sit there listening to this, you are outputting massive amounts of data through your physical body. And simultaneously, your brain is being programmed by the specific syntax and linguistic structures of the people around you.
We are unpacking a comprehensive document today titled The Art of Mentalism by Daniel Smith. And we really need to establish a firm boundary right away here.
Oh, for sure.
When the source discusses mentalism, it completely strips away the theatrical smoke and mirrors. We are not looking at stage magicians pulling rabbits out of hats.
Right. There's no like sawing people in half here.
No, exactly the opposite. It is the profound, systematic application of behavioral psychology, acute observation, and, linguistic suggestion. We are going to extract the precise methods of reading human hardware, the body, and decode the psychological scripting languages used to influence the software, which is the mind.
Because to an untrained observer, a highly skilled mentalist appears to be psychic.
Yeah, they really do.
They seem to pluck these impossibly accurate details out of thin air. But the reality is far more grounded in biology and honestly, far more terrifying.
Oh, absolutely.
They are just reading the unwritten physical language that your nervous system leaks without your permission. And they're utilizing highly engineered verbal scripts to bypass the critical analytical firewalls of your brain. So by the end of this deep dive, you are going to view every conversation as a matrix of visible cues and invisible influences.
Well, the transition from passive observer to active mentalist, it requires a fundamental upgrade to your basic sensory hardware. The source document begins with that exact exercise you mentioned, the neighbor's gate or door. If you cannot recall the color of an object you pass every single day, it means your observational awareness is essentially dormant.
Wow, dormant.
Yeah. Your brain's reticular activating system, that's the bundle of nerves at our brainstem that filters out unnecessary information, it has determined that the color of the gate is irrelevant to your survival. So it just drops the data packet.
But for a mentalist,
Yeah.
that data packet is the entire ball game. I mean, you can't read the complex code of human psychology if you can't even see the basic physical environment.
Exactly.
So the source prescribes a very specific method of conscious practice. You basically have to actively force your brain to start noticing the mundane.
Right, it's intentional.
Yeah, like when you walk
Yeah.
down the street, you consciously log the empty crisp packet on the sidewalk. You analyze the exact typography of the letter E on a local grocery store sign. You note the specific shade of blue of a passing car, and then, and this is key, force yourself to turn around 3 seconds later and verify it.
And the goal here isn't to just memorize the street. The goal is neuroplasticity.
Okay.
You are training the brain's filtering system to alter its parameters. You're teaching your reticular activating system to temporarily stop discarding what it traditionally labels as useless background noise.
I do have to push back on the practicality of this, though. I mean, if I actually try to live my life like a walking security camera,
Yeah.
actively analyzing the typography of every sign and the color of every single vehicle, the cognitive load would be astronomical. I'd
Yeah.
be exhausted before I even reached the office. How is this sustainable?
You are hitting on a crucial point regarding cognitive load, but the mechanism of this training is widely misunderstood. The objective is not permanent conscious hypervigilance. The text actually uses a brilliant analogy. It says it's like learning how to ride a bicycle.
Right, okay. When you first get on a bike, you're consciously thinking about your balance, the angle of the handlebars, the pressure on the pedals.
Yes.
It takes like 100% of your processing power just to stay upright.
But what happens after a month? The conscious processing shifts to the basal ganglia, which is the part of the brain responsible for subconscious habit formation.
Oh, wait.
It becomes an automatic reflex. The conscious practice of logging crypt packets and car colors works the exact same way. Eventually, the act of scanning drops below the threshold of conscious effort.
So you don't even have to think about it anymore.
Exactly. You no longer have to try to observe the room. Your brain simply upgrades its default processing speed and database capacity. And this is a non-negotiable prerequisite. Because if you cannot reliably notice a bright red car passing you at 20 miles an hour, you have zero hope of catching a fleeting, microscopic muscle twitch on someone's face.
Which perfectly transitions us into the primary monitor of human emotion, the face. Once the observational hardware is upgraded, the deep dive zooms in on what the text calls micro-expressions.
Right, the real tell.
Yeah, these are moments where the subconscious mind literally leaks its true programming in fractions of a second. Earlier, I was thinking about this in terms of software. If the human face is the user interface, like the UI we present to the world, then micro-expressions are essentially software glitches.
I'd love that.
It's the true background program crashing through the UI for a split second before the system can catch the error and cover it up.
That is a phenomenal conceptual framework because it highlights the involuntary nature of the phenomenon. You cannot consciously generate a software glitch.
Right.
These glitches were first formally categorized in 1966 by researchers Haggard and Isaacs. They were analyzing hours of psychotherapy sessions, playing the film back frame by agonizing frame, and they noticed these micromomentary expressions flashing across patients' faces when they were actively trying to suppress an emotion.
Wow.
We are talking about muscle movements lasting less than 1/5 of a second.
But the true pioneer here, the researcher who really mapped the code, is Dr. Paul Ekman. And his methodology is fascinating because he had to answer a massive underlying question.
Yeah.
Are these facial expressions just cultural conditioning? Like, do we smile because we see people on television smiling? Or is it baked into our biological hardware?
And to isolate those variables, Ekman realized he couldn't test people in New York or London or Tokyo. He had to find a population completely devoid of media influence.
Because everyone else is already programmed.
Exactly. So in the late 1960s, he traveled to Papua New Guinea to study the Four Tribe. This was an isolated, pre-literate culture with absolutely zero contact with the outside world. No magazines, no movies, no interactions with other cultures.
But how do you even conduct that study? You can't just hand them a multiple choice questionnaire. Did you just show them pictures of American stockbrokers and ask them what the person was feeling?
It required a completely narrative approach. Ekman would tell them specific, emotionally charged stories. For example, he would say, your child has died, or you are about to step on a rotting dead pig, or you are about to fight an enemy. Very. He would then ask them to point to a photograph of a Western face that matched the emotion of the story. Then, crucially, he asked them to physically demonstrate the face they would make in that scenario, and he recorded their muscle movements.
And the data came back identical. The isolated tribesmen stepping on a rotting pig made the exact same facial muscle configurations as a Parisian waiter smelling spoiled milk.
Yes.
Ekman proved that there are 7 universally hardwired expressions: happiness, sadness, contempt, anger, fear, surprise, and disgust. The hardware is identical across the entire species.
What Ekman also discovered, which the source emphasizes heavily, is that only about 1% of the population naturally spots these micro-expressions in real time.
Just 1%.
He called them naturals or wizards. For the remaining 99% of us, we have to deliberately train our upgraded visual processing to catch them.
So let's break down the specific anatomy of these 7 glitches. I don't want to just list them. I want to understand the mechanical code. Let's start with the evolutionary threat responses. Disgust and anger. The source calls disgust a major relationship killer.
Disgust is arguably the most primal and lingering of the 7. It evolved as a physiological mechanism to protect us from toxic substances and airborne pathogens.
Okay.
When you experience disgust, the nose wrinkles and the upper lip raises. Biologically, you are physically restricting your nasal passages to prevent a toxic smell from entering your body.
But obviously, in a modern office environment, you aren't usually smelling rotting meat.
Right, exactly. The human brain co-opted that biological hardware and applied it to social toxicity.
Oh, wow.
If you are presenting an idea in a meeting or speaking to a partner, and you catch that micro expression, the wrinkled nose, the raised upper lip, even if their words are perfectly polite, their underlying biological program is screaming that they find your ideas or your presence toxic. They want distance from you.
That is deeply unsettling, but incredibly useful. Now, contrast that with anger. The source makes a fascinating distinction about the onset of anger. It notes that genuine anger has a jagged building onset. It almost never explodes out of nowhere.
When you see someone go from perfectly calm to slamming their fists on a table in a nanosecond, you are almost always watching a fabricated performative script.
They're faking it.
They are trying to intimidate you. True anger requires a massive dump of adrenaline and cortisol, which takes a moment to flood the system. When anger flashes as a genuine microexpression, the anatomical code is very specific.
What are we looking for?
The eyebrows are pulled down and together, creating vertical lines. The eyes narrow into a hard glare, fixing on the target. And crucially, the lips press tightly together, narrowing the visible red part of the lips. The jaw is bracing for physical impact.
Okay, so moving from the aggressive emotions to the high alert emotions, let's look at fear and surprise. The source notes that these two are incredibly easy to confuse because they utilize very similar facial real estate.
They share evolutionary roots. Both fear and surprise require the eyes to widen dramatically.
Right.
Biologically, the brain needs to take in as much visual data as possible to assess a sudden change in the environment. But the context and the subtle muscle variations are the key decoders. Let's look at surprise first. Surprise is the easiest emotion to fake.
Oh, wow. A surprise party, I had absolutely no idea.
Precisely. But the biological truth of genuine surprise is that it is instantaneous and fleeting. The moment the brain processes the new information, the surprise vanishes.
Makes sense.
If someone holds a shocked, open-mouthed expression for longer than 1 second, it is a conscious, fabricated display.
So what differentiates fear from that instantaneous surprise?
In fear, the eyebrows go up, just like surprise, but they are pulled together, creating distinct wrinkles in the center of the forehead.
Ah, pulled together.
Yeah. The upper eyelid is raised, but the lower eyelid is tense and drawn up. And the defining tell is in the mouth. The lips are stretched horizontally backwards, pulling tight toward the ears. It is a face preparing to scream or gasp for oxygen.
That's a very specific visual.
Very. If you confront someone with a difficult question and you see that horizontal lip stretch flash for a fraction of a second, their internal program is terrified of being caught.
Then we have contempt. This one is entirely unique among the seven. It's the only asymmetrical expression.
Right. It defies the bilateral symmetry of the human face. Contempt only appears on one side.
Just one side.
You will see one corner of the lip tighten and stretch out and slightly up toward the ear. It is often referred to as a smirk, but clinically, it is a broadcast of moral superiority.
The source illustrates this with a famous image of George Bush during a press conference. And just to be perfectly clear for you listening, whenever our source references political figures, we are purely analyzing the anatomical mechanics of the muscles. We are not making any partisan commentary. We are just reading the raw biological code.
Exactly. It is a textbook example of the buccinator muscle contracting on one side. You will frequently see this micro-expression flash right after someone has successfully executed a lie or when they are listening to someone they believe is intellectually inferior. It is the biological leakage of arrogance.
Finally, we have the social emotions, sadness, and happiness. The source notes that sadness is incredibly difficult to spot because it's fundamentally an emotion of withdrawal, so the physical markers are subtle.
Sadness is the system powering down. The eyelids droop, the eyes lose focus, the corners of the lips pull down. But the most reliable microtell is the inner corners of the eyebrows.
The inner corners.
Yes. They are pulled up and together, creating an inverted V shape. People will constantly try to mask this withdrawal by plastering a smile over it.
Which brings us to the difference between a real smile and a fake one. How do we spot the counterfeit happiness?
The secret resides entirely in the orbicularis oculi, the muscles surrounding the eyes. A genuine smile, scientifically known as a Duchenne smile, is involuntary. The zygomatic major muscle pulls the lip corners up, but simultaneously, the orbicularis oculi contract, pulling down the eyebrows and the skin below the eye, creating wrinkles or crow's feet at the outer corners.
So you can't fake the eye wrinkles.
You cannot consciously flex those specific eye muscles. So if the cheeks push up, but the skin around the eyes remains smooth and static, the happiness is a forced, socially engineered script.
It's incredible how much data is flashing across the face in a fifth of a second. But the face is just the high-resolution monitor. To get the full diagnostic picture of someone's internal operating system, the mentalist must zoom out and read the entire physical unit.
Yes.
The source cites the famous and sometimes misunderstood statistic that 93% of communication is nonverbal body language.
We need to contextualize that statistic carefully. It doesn't mean that the literal words don't matter at all. It means that when the spoken words and the body language are incongruent, when they contradict each other, the human brain will default to trusting the physical body 93% of the time.
That's a huge margin.
It is. If we consider the spoken words as just the raw text file, the body language is the complex formatting, the font, the color, and the underlying code that give the text its actual meaning. The body reveals the macro trends of the person's emotional state.
And the text categorizes these macro trends broadly into positive and negative signs. And some of these are completely autonomic, meaning they bypass conscious control entirely. Pupil dilation, for instance.
A perfect example.
If you are explaining a concept to someone and their pupils physically expand, they lean in toward you and they rest their chin on their thumb and index finger, that is the involuntary biological code for deep, genuine interest, their brain is literally trying to let more light in to see you better.
Conversely, if you are pitching an idea and they begin leaning backward, creating physical distance between their torso and yours, if they start fiddling with a pen or their watch and their eyelids drop to half-mast, you are watching an internal program desperately trying to execute an escape routine.
Wow. An escape routine.
Yes. The physical distance is a subconscious attempt to remove themselves from a situation they find draining or threatening.
Within these broader trends, the source highlights some highly specific gestures. One that stood out is called the steepling method. This is when a person brings their hands up, fingers lightly touching tip to tip, but the palms are kept apart. It looks exactly like a little church steeple.
Steepling is an absolute broadcast of supreme confidence and authority.
Okay.
Mechanically, by holding the hands in front of the torso with the palms apart, the person is exposing their chest and stomach, which are their most vital organs. Biologically, you only expose your vital organs when you feel zero threat from your environment.
The source mentions you see this constantly in high-stakes environments.
Yeah.
Imagine a tense chess match. Player A reaches out to move a knight. Player B suddenly sits back and steeples their fingers.
Oh, that's devastating.
Player B isn't just resting their hands. Their nervous system is signaling that they have a trap waiting and they are supremely confident. Or in a job interview, if you are answering a complex question and the interviewer steeples their fingers, it is a tremendous biological indicator that they are highly impressed and assured of your competence.
But the truly fascinating moments occur when the conscious mind loses the battle with the subconscious, resulting in what the text calls gesture slips.
Gesture slips.
This is where the underlying emotion bypasses the filter entirely and acts itself out physically, often without the person even realizing it.
The source gives a stunning mechanical example of this featuring Barack Obama. And again, pure impartial analysis here. During a political debate, he is speaking diplomatically and respectfully about his opponent, John McCain. But as he speaks, he subtly raises his hand to scratch the side of his face using precisely his extended middle finger.
Again, looking at this purely as a mechanical output of the nervous system, it is a flawless example of a gesture slip.
Incredible.
The conscious mind, the prefrontal cortex, is executing a polite, carefully vetted verbal script. But the subconscious mind, which is feeling frustration or hostility toward the opponent, forces the motor cortex to execute a universally recognized gesture of aggression, disguised as an innocent biological itch. The subconscious literally finds a loophole to express its true state.
The subconscious flipping the bird. And the text dives deeply into the physical leakage of deception and doubt. When someone is fabricating a lie, the cognitive load is immense.
Oh, mess.
The brain has to keep the lie straight, monitor your reaction, and suppress the truth. This overload causes massive physical leakage. One method is verbal deflection, repeating the question back to you, like, did I take the money from the register? I think I saw it earlier.
They are simply buffering. They are buying processor time to generate the fabricated narrative.
Right.
But the physical signs of withdrawal are even more telling. Watch a politician or a corporate spokesperson deliver a statement they know is false. The moment they finish the sentence, they will often take a literal physical step backward.
Just one step.
Just a microscopic retreat. It is a physical manifestation of distancing themselves from the toxic lie they just expelled into the room.
You also see lip pursing, where the lips disappear into the mouth as if the brain is trying to physically hold the true words inside.
Mm-hmm.
You see hand rubbing, which is a pacifying, self-soothing gesture to calm the spike in anxiety.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You will frequently hear a sudden drop in vocal volume because the brain lacks confidence in the fabricated story, so it instinctively quiets the projection. Or the most glaring contradiction, the body physically arguing with the mouth. Someone saying, yes, I agree with your proposal, while their head subtly shakes no side to side.
In any instance of incongruence, trust the hardware. The physical code will almost always align with the biological truth, while the verbal code is easily manipulated.
But I have to stop us here and play devil's advocate. If I take all this literally, I'm going to become a paranoid body language conspiracy theorist.
Well, yes, that's a risk.
If I'm talking to my friend and he rubs his hands together, couldn't it just be a cold day? If his pupils are dilated, maybe we're just in a dimly lit restaurant. Mm-hmm. If he scratches his nose with his middle finger, maybe his nose just genuinely itches. How do we avoid misdiagnosing everyone around us?
That is the single most important caveat in the entire field of behavioral analysis. You cannot, under any circumstances, read a single piece of physical code in isolation. The text introduces the foundational concept of the baseline. Before you apply any of these advanced diagnostic methods, you must observe the person in a normal, relaxed state. You have to calibrate your sensors to their specific default settings.
So, establishing the control group for that specific individual.
Precisely. How do they normally sit? Do they normally fidget? What is their normal vocal cadence? If you are dealing with a naturally anxious, fidgety person whose baseline involves constantly rubbing their hands, then seeing them rub their hands during a negotiation does not indicate deception. It's just their baseline.
The golden rule the text stresses is to always, always look for clusters of gestures.
Yes. A one-sided shoulder shrug in isolation might literally just be a muscle spasm. It means nothing.
Right.
But if you ask a challenging question and you observe a one-sided shoulder shrug combined with a sudden drop in vocal volume, followed by a physical step backward and a flash of horizontal lip stretching, that cluster is a massive flashing red diagnostic warning indicating severe doubt or deception.
Okay, so we've established the architecture of observation. We know how to read the internal state of others, decoding their physical and facial output. But mentalism isn't a passive sport. The ultimate goal is active influence. The next step is actively altering their state. And the foundational method for this, the gateway to influence, is mirroring.
Mirroring is the biological process of subconsciously aligning your physical and linguistic output with another person to build deep, rapid rapport.
Okay.
This isn't a trick. It's rooted deeply in evolutionary psychology and the function of mirror neurons in the brain. If you observe two close friends deeply engaged in a conversation at a coffee shop, you almost always see them sitting in the exact same posture, leaning at the same angle, even picking up their coffee cups at the same time. Their nervous systems have synchronized.
The text explains that the mentalist consciously reverse engineers this biological synchronicity to fast-track trust. You act as their physical reflection. If they cross their left leg over their right, you wait a beat and you cross your right leg over your left. If they lean on their left elbow, you lean on your right. You are transmitting a continuous subconscious signal that says, look at us. We are the same. We belong to the same tribe. You are safe with me.
It effectively bypasses the amygdala's stranger danger threat detection system. But what elevates this concept from basic psychology to advanced mentalism is how the source applies it to the modern era. The text delves deeply into digital or remote mirroring.
This part completely recontextualizes how I view my own phone. It's not just about physical posture. The source talks about mirroring via text message.
Oh, yeah.
It's matching their digital syntax.
Yeah.
If a colleague texts you in short, punchy, lowercase fragments without punctuation, and you reply with a formally structured, capitalized paragraph ending in a period, you are creating digital dissonance. You are signaling that you operate on different systems.
Exactly. Texting is an extension of our communicative baseline. To mirror digitally, you adopt their syntax. If they use specific emojis, you use those same emojis. If they use multiple exclamation points, you match that emotional frequency. If they wait 10 minutes to reply, you wait 10 minutes to reply. When you match their digital rhythm, their brain registers the exact same feeling of psychological alignment and comfort as if you were sitting in the same posture across a table.
The text even mentions mirroring over a voice call by matching the rhythm of their breathing. You actively listen to the cadence of their inhales and exhales, and you align your own respiratory rate to match theirs.
Which engages the parasympathetic nervous system. When your breathing synchronizes, your heart rates literally begin to co-regulate.
But I have to jump in here, because matching someone's respiratory rate over the phone sounds incredibly invasive. Is there a massive risk of crossing the line from building subconscious rapport to just completely creeping someone out?
Well, yeah.
If I'm talking to someone and I suddenly realize they're perfectly mimicking my breathing in every physical movement I make, my threat detection system is going to go haywire.
And it absolutely should. That is why the text is incredibly strict about the execution. Mirroring cannot be simultaneous.
Okay, that's key.
Simultaneous execution is mimicry, which the brain interprets as mockery or a predatory threat. The method relies entirely on a calculated delay. They shift their weight, you wait 3 to 5 seconds, and then you organically shift yours.
Subtle.
The movement must be executed so subtly that it remains entirely below the threshold of their conscious awareness. The exact second their prefrontal cortex notices what you are doing, the firewall slams shut, the illusion of organic connection is broken, and trust evaporates permanently.
The source also points out a critical layer to this. You cannot mirror everyone using the exact same template. To tailor these influence methods, you have to accurately diagnose their personality baseline. Specifically, you must determine whether their operating system is built around an introverted or extroverted architecture.
And the text provides a highly clinical definition of these terms, moving far beyond the simplistic labels of shy versus outgoing.
Right.
It defines introversion and extroversion entirely by how the brain processes and depletes energy. Introverts experience a rapid drain of neurological energy in highly stimulating, multivariable social settings.
They get overwhelmed.
Exactly. Their brains are highly sensitive to dopamine, so too much external stimulation overwhelms them. They must recharge by isolating themselves. They favor deep, singular concepts over rapid-fire small talk. And crucially, they process their thoughts internally before they output speech.
Whereas extroverts have a higher threshold for dopamine. They require external stimulation to feel energized. Isolation drains their batteries. And the key diagnostic indicator the text mentions, extroverts often process their thoughts externally. They think best while they are talking, essentially using their speech as a real-time drafting process.
Therefore, your mirroring strategy must adapt. If you diagnose a baseline as introverted, your mirroring must be calibrated down. Slower physical movements, lower vocal volume, leaving longer pauses in the conversation to allow for their internal processing.
Match the energy?
Exactly. If they are extroverted, you match their high frequency energy, you engage in rapid verbal volleying, and you use larger, more expansive gestures. You must align your script to their specific hardware limitations.
So let's assemble the pieces. By combining acute visual observation, diagnosing the personality baseline, and bypassing the threat detection firewall through precise physical and digital mirroring, the mentalist sets the perfect stage.
They do.
They have root access to the target's trust. And this leads us to Section 5, the ultimate illusion of psychic ability, cold reading.
Cold reading is the pinnacle application of reading the unspoken code. It is the complex art of convincing a complete stranger that you possess intimate, impossible knowledge about their private life, their past, and their personality.
Wow.
And the text is unequivocal. The core fuel engine that makes cold reading function is not magic. It is an air of absolute, unshakable confidence. The mentalist must act as an unquestionable authority figure.
The text provides the exact step-by-step playbook for this illusion. It all begins with a phase called staging. Imagine a psychic or a mentalist sitting across from you. They close their eyes, furrow their brow, and say, I'm sorry, I'm struggling to connect with the spiritual energy today. The signal's weak. Just give me a minute.
To the naive observer, this validates the difficulty of the psychic process, but mechanically, it is a brilliant stall tactic.
They're stalling.
They are not talking to spirits. They are buying processing time to hyperscan you. While you sit patiently, they are running a diagnostic on your clothing, your posture, the calluses on your hands indicating manual labor versus office work, the presence of a wedding ring, the level of fatigue around your eyes. They are gathering the raw data necessary to write the script they are about to feed you.
Once they have that data, they transition into another call, fishing. This is where they drop incredibly vague, wide net bait. The text uses a classic example. The mentalist says, I'm seeing the letter J. Does a J mean anything to you?
It is neurologically brilliant because it utilizes apophenia, which is the human brain's natural tendency to seek patterns and meaning in random data.
Oh, apophenia.
Yeah. The mentalist just throws the phonetic sound J into the air. The subject's brain desperately searches its vast internal database for a match. The subject gasps and says, "Oh my God, my Uncle John passed away last year." The mentalist knew absolutely nothing about an Uncle John. The subject supplied 100% of the specific data, and the mentalist simply nods sagely and accepts the credit for the hit.
It's weaponized confirmation bias. But the heavy artillery of cold reading relies on something called the Forer effect. The source provides a specific paragraph written by psychologist Bertram R. Forer in 1948. He gave this exact paragraph to his students, claiming it was a highly personalized, unique personality assessment based on a test they took. Every single student rated it as incredibly accurate to their specific life.
Let's actually look at the structural mechanics of that text. What does the script actually say?
I have it right here. It says things like, you have a great need for other people to like and admire you. You have a tendency to be critical of yourself. You have a great deal of unused capacity, which you have not turned to your advantage. While you have some personality weaknesses, you're generally able to compensate for them. Disciplined and self-controlled outside, you tend to be worrisome and insecure inside. When I read this, I laughed because it reads like an astrological horoscope on steroids.
It is a masterclass in generalized psychological scripting. The phenomenon is also known as the Burnham effect.
Right.
The script is engineered with so many universal human truths. I mean, who doesn't worry on the inside while trying to look calm on the outside? That it acts as a mirror. The listener projects their own highly specific life experiences onto the vague framework. The script forces the listener to do all the heavy lifting to make it true.
But why does our brain accept it so willingly? Why don't we immediately see through the vagueness?
Because of the evolutionary desire for social validation and self-esteem preservation, human beings inherently crave being understood, and they desperately want to hear positive, complex things about themselves.
That makes a lot of sense.
The source notes a highly specific linguistic trick. If you sandwich a mild, relatable negative statement like, you tend to be worrisome between two highly complementary generalizations like discipline outside and unused capacity, the subject's ego will bend over backward to validate the reading. They want the narrative to be true, so their critical mind steps aside.
The source details another fascinating variation of this narrative hacking called psychometry. This involves the mentalist asking to hold a highly personal object belonging to the subject, a wedding ring, a watch, a necklace. They close their eyes, physically rubbing the object, and deliver a reading based on highly ambiguous imagery. The example the text gives is the mentalist saying, "I'm seeing a white door."
This is where we see the power of branching narrative pathways. The script is designed so that the mentalist cannot lose. If the subject connects with the literal imagery, like, "Oh, wow, the door to my childhood home was white," the mentalist rides that validation and expands into a broad generalization. Yes, I sense you had some complex emotional ups and downs with your parents growing up. It's universally true, but it feels profoundly specific in the moment.
But I kept wondering, what happens when the subject rejects the bait? What if they say, "A white door means absolutely nothing to me, you're wrong"? Does the illusion just shatter?
Not if the mentalist understands the script. The method dictates an immediate, smooth pivot from the literal to the symbolic. The mentalist simply lowers their voice and says, "Ah, no, it is not a literal physical door. The white door represents a major life transition you are contemplating, a dream you feel is unachieved. You are currently looking for the internal key to open this white door."
That is so slick.
It is a flawless, bulletproof linguistic structure. If the subject accepts the literal, the mentalist wins. If the subject rejects the literal, the mentalist pivots to the symbolic and still wins.
It is deeply unsettling when you break it down like that. Cold reading works by feeding the subject a narrative framework and letting their own brain fill in the variables. But the deep dive takes a massive, profound turn here as we enter section 6. Because if cold reading is merely feeding someone a script, hypnosis takes this process to its ultimate conclusion by literally rewriting the brain's temporary operating system. We are talking about using highly specific verbal scripting languages to command the human nervous system.
And before we unpack the syntax of those scripts, we have to aggressively dismantle a massive cultural misconception. The text is very, very clear on this point. Hypnosis is absolutely not sleep. The subject is not unconscious.
Right. It's not the swinging pocket watch making you pass out.
It is the exact opposite. It is a hyper-aware, hyper-attentive state of deep physical relaxation combined with heightened neurological suggestibility. In fact, the text points out that every single person listening to this goes into natural, light, hypnotic trances multiple times a day. Oh, yeah. If you have ever been daydreaming while staring out a window, completely oblivious to someone calling your name, you were in a light trance. Or the classic phenomenon of highway hypnosis, where you drive for 30 miles on the interstate and suddenly realize you have no conscious memory of the last 20 minutes.
Because the conscious mind, the prefrontal cortex, got bored and checked out, and your subconscious mind seamlessly took over the complex motor program of driving the car at 70 miles an hour. And the quote that truly anchored this concept for me in the text was, "All hypnosis is ultimately self-hypnosis. The hypnotist has no magical power. They are simply the verbal guide. The subject's brain is doing the actual rendering."
To guide the subject into that rendering state, the mentalist utilizes the scripting language of what are called deepeners.
Deepeners.
The source provides actual verbatim scripts used to transition someone from a state of light relaxation into a profound, highly suggestible trance. They utilize spatial counting methods, like counting backward from 10 down to 1, or visualizing walking down a heavy 10-step oak stairway.
And when you analyze the text of these scripts, you realize it's entirely built on repetitive linguistic loops. The hypnotist continually hits highly specific phonetic command words. I'm going to count backwards from 10 to 1. With every number, you are going deeper, moving down, sinking lower into heavy relaxation.
Yes.
The rhythmic repetition of those specific concepts, depth, weight, downward motion, creates a biological feedback loop. The brain hears heavy and sends a signal to relax the muscles. The muscles relax and feel heavier, which confirms the verbal command, driving the subject deeper.
But the most potent and frankly the most dangerous application discussed in the source is covert or conversational hypnosis.
This part is wild.
This is the advanced method of inducing a hypnotic trance state in someone without their knowledge during a completely normal daylight conversation, often to lower their stress levels or bypass their resistance to an idea.
This is where we get into serious psychological hacking. The text lays out a precise three-step method for conversational hypnosis. Step one, build rapport. We already know how to execute this using the subtle physical and digital mirroring techniques we discussed earlier. You align your system with theirs. But step two is where the script gets wild. Switch off the critical mind.
The critical mind is the brain's analytical firewall. It is the skepticism engine that questions reality, looks for threats, and evaluates logic. To bypass that firewall, you cannot use direct commands. The conversational hypnotist utilizes very specific linguistic Trojan horses, primarily the bypass words imagine or what if.
The example provided in the text is brilliantly simple. If I look at you and say, "What if a black cat could fly?" The exact millisecond you hear those words, your brain generates an image of a flying black cat. You literally cannot stop the rendering process. The phrase "what if" or "imagine" is exactly like entering developer mode on a smartphone. Once you type in that passcode, you have bypassed the user interface and gained root access to the person's imagination. The firewall lets the command through because it is tagged as a harmless hypothetical. Oh, it's just an exercise. I'll drop my defenses.
Your analogy of root access is biologically perfect. The human brain cannot resist these specific linguistic commands because of the fundamental architecture of our visual cortex. When you ask the brain to imagine an outcome, the brain utilizes the exact same neural pathways to render the imagination as it would if it were actually experiencing the event in physical reality.
That's incredible.
The subconscious brain struggles to differentiate between a vividly imagined, highly sensory event and a real one.
So once you have breached the firewall and secured root access, you transition to step three, hypnotic commands. The text provides a conversational script specifically designed to lower someone's physiological stress. You intertwine rich sensory language with the bypass word. You say, imagine you are standing on a warm beach. Imagine the sound of soft waves lapping. What if you could feel that deep, heavy relaxation in your shoulders right now?
Really?
Because the firewall is down, their brain takes that imagined sensory data, processes it as reality, and literally sends biological commands to the nervous system to drop the heart rate and release muscle tension. You are hacking their physiology through their imagination.
And the power of this scripting language isn't limited to influencing others. The text concludes the section on hypnosis by turning the tool inward, detailing a comprehensive 13-step method for self-hypnosis.
Okay.
This process, which takes 30 to 60 minutes in a quiet environment, involves systematically relaxing the body from the toes to the head, visualizing the descent down the 10-step staircase, and then planting a highly specific positive behavioral goal within a peaceful mental visualization before counting back up to full wakefulness. It is using the exact same linguistic bypass techniques to rewrite your own internal programming.
Which provides the perfect transition into the final phase of our deep dive today, reverse engineering. Throughout this entire exploration, the focus has been externally directed. We've analyzed how to read the visual code of others and how to script the behavior of others. But the ultimate, most profound application of mentalism, according to the text, is using these exact physical methods to actively re-script your own baseline behavior.
It is the ultimate manifestation of self-directed neuroplasticity. And the entire concept hinges on a phrase that sounds like a cheap motivational cliche, but is actually rooted in profound biological truth. Fake it till you make it.
The source makes a fascinating assertion: human feelings often work backward. We operate under the assumption that the software drives the hardware. We think, I feel happy, therefore my brain tells my face to smile. But the text notes that the hardware can dictate the software. Physically forcing your facial muscles into a Duchenne smile actually generates the feeling of happiness in the brain. Sitting up straight and expanding your chest physically generates neurological energy. The physical code you input dictates the emotional output.
In cognitive science, this is known as embodied cognition. Your brain is constantly monitoring what your physical body is doing to figure out how it should be feeling.
That is wild.
If your posture is slumped, your arms are crossed defensively, and your breathing is shallow, your brain interprets that physical data and concludes, we must be under threat or in a state of defeat, and it releases stress hormones like cortisol. If you take up physical space, open your posture, and breathe deeply, your brain concludes, we are safe and dominant, and it releases testosterone and lowers cortisol, generating the feeling of confidence.
The text provides an incredibly practical list of 18 specific methods to consciously improve your own body language script, essentially giving you a manual to hack your own baseline. Let's look closely at a few of the most powerful ones. First on the list, consciously uncrossing arms and legs.
Simple but effective.
We established earlier that cross limbs are a defensive, closed-off biological code. By forcing yourself to uncross them, you physically remove the defensive barrier, which forces your brain to lower its internal guard and feel more open and receptive.
Second, maintaining eye contact without staring. This requires recalibrating your visual output to signal engagement, confidence, and respect without triggering the amygdala's threat response in the other person, which a hard, unblinking stare would do.
Right.
Third, taking up physical space. Spreading your arms slightly, sitting more broadly in a chair, this is spatial dominance. It signals authority to the room, but more importantly, it signals self-assurance to your own nervous system.
Fourth, keeping your head up and your gaze forward while walking. The text notes that people who walk with their head down, staring at their phones or the pavement, physically appear lost and insecure to observers. But due to embodied cognition, by constantly adopting the physical posture of feeling lost, they eventually feel internally lost and insecure. Raising the chin alters the internal state.
It really does.
Fifth, eliminating face touching. We learned that touching the face or rubbing the neck are autonomic, self-soothing gestures that broadcast nervous leakage. Consciously stopping those movements makes you appear far more grounded and, in turn, calms the internal anxiety loop. And sixth, replacing that nervous fidgeting with deliberate, controlled hand gestures that add rhythmic force to your verbal points.
However, there is a massive, highly predictable friction point here that the text openly acknowledges and warns the reader about.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the entire time I was reading the list.
Yeah.
If I go into work tomorrow and spend my entire 8-hour shift consciously screaming at my body, uncross legs, raise chin, gesture with right hand now, breathe slowly. Isn't that going to feel incredibly disjointed and robotic? Will I just feel like an imposter awkwardly operating a flesh mech?
It is a completely valid and expected concern. The text explicitly validates this feeling, noting that when you first begin applying these physical scripts, it will feel exaggerated, clumsy, weird, and highly inauthentic. You have to remember, you are actively attempting to override decades of deeply entrenched default programming in your basal ganglia.
It's exactly like trying to write your signature with your non-dominant hand. It requires massive conscious effort and feels entirely wrong.
Precisely. But here is the biological mechanism of permanent change: repetition forces neuroplasticity. Through the consistent, disciplined execution of these new physical scripts, the repetition forces your brain to build entirely new neural pathways.
Wow.
What starts as a conscious, clunky, exhausting effort eventually transitions into the realm of the subconscious. The feeling of weirdness fades, the conscious effort drops away, and the new behaviors permanently overwrite your old baseline. You don't just act confident. The new biological code runs automatically, and you literally become confident.
Wow. Okay, let's take a step back and look at the massive journey we've navigated today. We started by ripping off the blinders, upgrading our fundamental visual hardware so we actually noticed the data in our environment instead of filtering it out.
From there, we learned to decode the microscopic glitches in human facial software. Those universally hardwired split-second expressions of disgust, fear, or contempt that reveal the raw, unfiltered program running beneath the social mask.
We zoomed out to read the macro trends of the entire body, identifying the defensive clusters, the gesture slips, the power of steepling, and the profound physical leakages of doubt and deception, always anchoring our analysis against a person's individual baseline.
We then crossed the critical threshold from passive observation to active influence. We explored the biology of mirroring, both physical posture and digital syntax, to engage the parasympathetic nervous system, bypass the amygdala, and build rapid, deep rapport.
We dismantled the illusion of psychic ability by reverse engineering cold reading, exposing how techniques like phishing, the Barnum effect, and the symbolic pivots of psychometry weaponize our own confirmation bias against us.
And finally, we decoded the ultimate scripting language of hypnosis. We learned how the simple bypass words imagine, and what if grant root access to the imagination, allowing us to plant hypnotic commands, and ultimately, how to use the principles of embodied cognition to rewrite our own internal hardware.
It genuinely fundamentally alters how you view human interaction. We started this deep dive talking about how conversations aren't just simple audio exchanges, but incredibly complex matrices of hidden codes. Now you actually understand the architecture of that code.
Which leaves us with a profound and frankly somewhat unsettling final thought to ponder as we close. If Dr. Ekman's research proves that our deepest emotional facial expressions are universally hardwired into our biology, if our body language and gesture slips are largely involuntary outputs of our nervous system, and if our conscious, highly guarded critical minds can be so easily bypassed and reprogrammed by a simple two-syllable trigger word like imagine.
It's crazy.
How much of our daily moment-to-moment interaction is truly a product of our own independent free will? And how much of it is just one set of biological programming blindly executing scripts against another? Next time you sit down across from someone to have a simple conversation, take a breath and ask yourself, in this matrix of hidden codes, are you the programmer or are you being programmed?